Truma, page 326. Page 326, Parsha Truma. Sentence number 1 and 2. It will get 1, 2, 3. As soon as we learn Torah, the warmth comes. If you don't feel it, means you're not learning. Guilt. If it's... Donna, why didn't you read sentence 1? You'll feel it in 1, 2, 3. Page 326. Go on. So this is a very important sentence. That I would like to emphasize, that Ba'al B'nai Israel, speak to the children of Israel, v'yikhu li truma, they shall take from me a truma, a offering. Now, I know some of you may know Hebrew better than other people. What is the root of the word truma? Hashoresh. Taram. Maha Hashoresh shel taram. What's the root of taram? Laharim, to lift up, from the word. So ultimately, if you give a truma, if you give an offering, you are lifted up. You feel elevated. Your spirit is elevated by giving, in the act of giving. How much should you give? May eight kol ish ashe yidvenu libo, according to how much your heart wants to give. So what is God saying? That every person from the Jewish people should give a truma. You should give a offering. And what will you do with this offering? The next sentence, Bell. In other words, you should take gold, silver, and brass. Go on, Carol. And all these things which are really material, go on. Continue. Go on. And then comes the main sentence in sentence 8 that I want to read myself. You should take all these things. And what should you do? Va'asu li mikdash. You shall make for me a mikdash. What is a mikdash? A sanctuary. V'shochanti v'tocham. And I shall dwell in... No. Among them. So let's focus a little bit on what is going on. God is asking everyone to give a gift. Something which you have, gold, silver, copper, different types of material. And what will I do with all this? I shall make for myself a mikdash. You shall make for me a mikdash, and I shall dwell in your midst. Now let's try to understand this on a much deeper level than has been suggested, okay? Obviously, we all know in Judaism there are many symbols. One of the biggest symbols that people are aware of is a sanctuary. And then within a sanctuary, there is an ark, which is known as, in Hebrew, a aron. Then there is a menorah. And all other things, both in this parsha and the next parsha, that are very important. Some of the other symbols is, let's say, what a kohen wears. A kohen wears certain things. So what I want to understand is, why is God telling us this at this particular juncture in history? Where are we in Jewish history right now? I don't mean right now in 1994, but where are we in Jewish history at this parsha? What has just finished taking place? We got the commandments and we had revelation. And revelation was there with the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. And revelation was there with all the laws of Mishpatim, which is a very complicated parsha. and all the laws between man and man and man and God, and how you should have property rights and all of that. So all of Revelation is done. And then God says, you should make for me a sanctuary. Let's try to think this one through, okay? All the laws are given, all the revelation is done, and then God says, make for me a sanctuary so that I can dwell in your midst. Very good, Lillian. Excellent. Let me tell you what Lillian said in my own words. As we said before, particularly last week, what is the name of God? Havaya, which means Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, which means to be. So ultimately, before this parsha, one can just be with God. That means you can walk in the forest, you can jump rope, you can do whatever you do on an ordinary day, alone and be with God. Most people are not able to really do that. And God is aware that most people cannot be with God just in regular life. But that's basically, before this parsha, that's on one level, that's what God wanted. That I give you my divine revelation and you just live your life and imbue the feeling of divinity within. But he also realizes that most people cannot do that. And that, it's interesting that most people cannot do it even now, even though we have this parsha. So therefore, one of the things which he has said is, I have built, listen carefully, I have built a world for you. God says, I have built a world for you. Now what I want you to do is build a world for me. So therefore, I have a synagogue, a sanctuary, a menorah, and this is the divine world that you are building for me. And why am I asking you to do this? Because this is the only way I recognize that you can relate to me. Because it's too hard to relate to me just through divine revelation. You need to relate to me through a symbol. And the symbol is a synagogue, a menorah, an ark, and all of that. Mm-hmm. Right. As a matter of fact, what Jeanette said is correct. Because as the Jewish people were traveling, what was their guide as they were traveling to Israel? Pillar of what? A cloud and fire. So as you travel and you see a cloud, that is the guide that I am with you. You don't need anything else. I am always with you in whatever you do, you just have to experience it. But he also knows people are not able to do that. And ultimately, this is the interesting thing that God is aware of, because this is what God is telling the Jewish people. I know people need something concrete, a symbol, in order to worship me. It's a very powerful thing, though. I don't know if you fully understand the intensity of this. In other words, worship can be just walking if you think a certain way. But he recognizes that people need symbols. Right. So therefore, what God is asking us to do is we have to build a godly world in the human world which he has built. And that is why, for example, people put a lot of emphasis, for those who have been to Israel, to the wall. It's like, what is the first thing that most people do when they arrive in Israel after they have a breakfast at the King David or something like that? They go to the wall, right? It's like, what pulls them in that magnetic way to the wall? That wall is Vasuli Mikdash Vishohanti Batoham. You shall make for me a Mikdash, and I shall dwell in your midst. Because you don't have to go to the wall. So God's presence is even as you travel to Israel. But people need something concrete. Yes, Dr. Clara. Yes, this is a very nice thing that God is doing, because without this, and without synagogue, and without a wall, and without a menorah, it's very, very difficult. So he recognizes, it's almost, this parsha tells us that God recognizes the frailty of humanity, that we need to touch and to hold something in a symbol. And then we can, so to say, put all our feelings into that symbol. But having that symbol, having the feeling in and of itself, is not enough. And therefore, whatever action you do is a form of that symbol. I'll explain that in one moment. Do you have a question, please? So what's your question? It's a good statement you made. It's not. And therefore, all symbols in different religious cultures serve the same purpose. And that's why I am comfortable, for example, in dealing with symbols of other religions. One second, let me finish before you butt me. So therefore, let's say a cross. I can imagine how a cross can be extremely comforting to a Christian. I'll tell you how I can imagine it. A cross, as you know, goes like this, right? So I can imagine a person feeling that my main connection is vertical between myself and God, but I want to feel that sense of divinity through horizontal, through my relationship. It's a very powerful. I can understand a person with the Star of David, and the Star of David has been written up in an interesting manner by Gershom Scholem and other people, having, if you really look at it, it's like two triangles. One triangle is ascendancy, which is known as the Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination, I want to do good. The other is the downward triangle, which is Yetzer Hara, that I have an evil inclination, and that's humanity and the human tendency. And I'm in the middle struggling with that. So whatever symbol you hold on to, it can put all your things into that symbol. And you feel somehow better by touching it. Yes, Lillian. Let me tell you why it has happened, which is interesting. Most people, and this is a sad state of affairs, most people need the concrete symbol so much that they do the concrete symbol and forget where it leads to. So therefore, if you look at concrete symbols, people are so much into that they forget that it's only a medium. And they hold on to it. And that would be a form of idolatry and cutting off. And many, many people have done that. That's why one of the prophets said in a beautiful way, Lama li rov zivchechem, why are you giving me all your sacrifices? Ki yodayim damim maleu, because your hands are full of blood. Don't you understand that the whole form of sacrifices, of worship, of synagogue, of symbols, is in order to get the relationship. It's not meant as an end in and of itself. And that has been the main difficulty in Judaism, that people have observed the law, L-A-W, without taking it to the next place. Yes, Diane. Right. But what I'm saying is people need this so much that sometimes people have gone the next step and have worshipped it. And that is the problem with it. Rather than allow your imagination to go and create even, I'm responding to you, Lillian, even you can create your own symbol. In other words, just to take a favorite symbol of many people, a menorah. Fine. It's nice. It has a lot of meaning. If you want to create your own symbol that has meaning for you, that is equally as significant. Yes, Albert. Very nice. Very nicely said. Very nice. And that type of thing, which Albert just said, allows for the religious imagination to really flow. Now, I said something before that I just want to explain. It's like any activity which you really do, which is a form of concretization, can be put into divine aspects. And one of the things which this is telling us, is when you make for me a sanctuary and you put all this artwork in it, and we'll go into some of the artwork which is in the sanctuary, this is a way of going from one level of life in an alchemical process of transformation going beyond that. And just the expression of that is a healing process. So, for example, I want to give you an example what Mark told me this morning. Mark, why don't you share with the class what you told me this morning, the work that you did for 14 years, because it relates to this. So therefore, when God is saying, "Va'asuli Mikdash, you shall make for me a sanctuary," means expressing it externally. So therefore, whatever one does is a form of religious activity that could make you feel better. Whether it's writing, or whether it's marathon running, whatever activity, if you can imbue it with the next phrase, "Vishohanti v'toham," and I shall dwell in your midst. Now, one of the things I always said, and I said this last year as well, look at the word Vishohanti. For those who know Hebrew, it is based on the word Shekhinah. That's the root of the word. And Shekhinah means the feminine aspect of divinity. The feminine aspect refers to relatedness. That the whole idea of having a symbol is to relate in a feminine way with divinity. Now, there's a beautiful sentence in one of the prophets that I happen to know by heart. It goes something like this. Hashemayim kisi, the heavens are my throne, v'ha'aretz hadom ra'glai, and the earth is the throne where I sit. Eizeh bayit tivnuli, what type of house are you going to build for me? V'eizeh makom menuchosi. And where will I get my final rest, says God. I created the whole world. It doesn't make sense for you to build a sanctuary. because I should not be confined to a sanctuary. What type of house are you going to build for me? Hashemayim Kisi. The heavens are my throne, and the earth is where I sit. No house is adequate for me. So therefore, he says, if you do this, not v'shochanti b'tocho, that I shall dwell in the house, but I shall dwell b'tocham, in you. And therefore, the whole idea of religious involvement with external symbols, whatever the symbol is, photography, art, running, writing, poetry, is the idea of a shochanti b'tocham. And the idea of a shochanti b'tocham. And that will bring about an alchemical transformation. And you'll feel better as a result of the difficulty of the human condition. This is not easy. Yes, ma'am. But basically what Hallie is saying, which is a very good point, if you take a look at sentence number 4, it says, and blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen and goat's hair. In other words, what God is saying, take the natural elements of the world that I have created, do something with them, and you will feel aspects of divinity by doing this. In other words, whatever is in the world is godly and will help you in your transformation. So you take the natural elements, and now you create a world for me. So basically, what God is saying, it's a very interesting thing. What God is saying is, I created a world for you, and now you create a world for me. And this is the way it will make it easier for you to relate to me. There's an interesting person. It was Martin Buber. I'll just mention this a little bit just to show you what he has done. I don't want to go into this now. It's too technical, but I do want to tell it to you. Martin Buber, in one of his works, says the following thing, and I think this was absolutely brilliant that no one discovered this until Martin Buber. He looks at the creation story, and he looks at this story, and he shows 7 parallels that I just want to show you. Number 1, it says in the creation story, Vayaz Elohim et Harakia, that God made the sky. And over here it says, Va'asuli Mikdash, you shall make for me a temple. So parallel number 1 is the word Vayaz, and he made, in Hebrew. It's this identical word. Parallel number 2, how many days did it take to create the world? 6. And he says over here that I'm going to show you in a moment that basically it was 6 days. Parallel number 3, that God rested on the 7th day in the creation story. The parallel to here, that on the 7th day, the cloud would then rest on top of the tabernacle. Parallel number 4, Vayuchulu Hashemayim, the world was completed. And parallel here, Vatechel, the same Hebrew word, that the word of the Mishkan was completed. Number 5, that God looked at everything which he did. And over here it says, and Moses looked at all the work. Number 6, God said it was very good. And here in this story, he says, Moses, you did exactly as I have created. And number 7, God blessed the 7 day. And over here, Vayivarech Otam Moshe, and Moshe blessed. So Martin Buber found 7 parallels, either conceptually, thematically, or verbally, of the creation story to the creation of the Mishkan. So ultimately, what God is telling us in a very beautiful way, I have created a world for you. I recognize that it is too difficult after divine revelation for you to relate to me. What you have to do right now in a concrete way is to create a world for me, which will ultimately be enabling you to relate to me. It's a really interesting thing that the other commentators from the Middle Ages, who usually have covered almost everything, didn't notice this. And it's a very interesting thing to show the parallelism between the creation of the natural world and the creation of the religious world. Tell me what you're saying. The concretization. Right. I see. Right. It's funny you say that, because that's exactly what I am. That's my next point. There was a medieval philosopher. I think his name was Ibn Daud, but I'm not 100% sure of which one right now. And he had a whole philosophy called Olam Katan, that every human individual is a microcosm of the macrocosm. Is Olam Katan means a small world, like in Disneyland, a small world. So the song from Disneyland is really based on Olam Katan, that each individual is a microcosm of the macrocosm. And therefore, if you study each individual and all the symbols and all his struggles, you have seen the entire macrocosm. Yes, Miriam. Who? The microcosm and macrocosm. Why we don't have more? So basically, what Miriam is saying is a good point. In our homes, and by the way, our homes are called in Hebrew. What's our home called in Hebrew? What? Yes. What? No. Mikdash. It's very interesting. Mikdash Ma'ad. Here it says, Vasuli Mikdash, you shall make for me a sanctuary. A home is called a Mikdash Ma'at, a miniature sanctuary. So if a home is a miniature sanctuary, then you suddenly have what Miriam said, you should have symbols in your home so that you have a sanctuary in your home. That your home should be like a sanctuary. And therefore, you have to create the ambience and atmosphere in the home in whichever way you want. Most people do not do that. Right. So they have the menorah. Where do they keep the menorah? In their break front, in the Aron, and they look at it, and it's for Hanukkah, but they don't internalize it on a regular basis. One of the interesting interpretations, and this was mentioned to me in a paper by one of my friends, Tom Hirsch, mentioned that the menorah is really symbolic of the burning bush. So therefore, you just take it one step further. You have a menorah at home. Can you see the burning bush in the menorah? And then suddenly your home becomes a mikdash. Now then, if your home becomes a mikdash, you're comfortable at being at home. Many people feel comfortable always leaving the home. But then if you make your home into a mikdash, then you feel comfortable in being in your home. So that is called a mikdash ma'at. Yes. So the essence is the symbols you create at home. The photography, the art, the menorah and other things. So it's nice to have the elegance, but it has to be in the relatedness. Mm-hmm. I like that. Good story. Yes, sir. Now, what's interesting, one of the symbols that's very interesting that you should have on an ark is something that I want to focus upon. And many people, it's a very interesting symbol that I've been thinking about a lot. And that is called the cherubim. In Hebrew, it's known as the kruvim. Who knows the first time where the kruvim are mentioned? Where's the first time? Very good, very good. Let's turn there. Did you know that from me or from yourself? The first time, page 13. Sentence, Dr. Spira reads sentence 23 and 24 on page 13. So, where were the kruvim put based on this sentence, Dr. Spira? Let's see if you understood the sentence. Right. And what was it meant to be to teach Adam? To keep him out of the Garden of Eden. And what does a kruvim look like? He has a flaming sword, but what does he look like? A childlike image. Well, that's... Yeah. Right. Cherubs. That's true. Where? In the Talmud that the kruvim are like childlike images. So the first image we have of the kruvim, listen carefully, okay? Because I'm getting to something interesting. That the first image we have of the kruvim is that man was expelled from the Garden of Eden. And he can never go back to the Garden of Eden. Now, what? No, but you can't go back because they have these swords there. I mean, they're going to block the passage. What? Okay, I won't say the word never. I'll never say the word never. What? Right. And it's interesting you said the tree of life because the last sentence, Marvin, the last sentence, the last word on page 13 is Lishmor Derech Eitz HaChayim, to keep the way to the tree of life. In other words, man cannot go back there to get to that tree of life. But just one second, so let me explain something. So where are these kruvim put in the Mishkan? Where are they put? Where are they put in the sanctuary? On top by the aron. I mean, I don't have it here, but in many synagogues, you have it on either side of the aron. What is in the aron? What is in the ark? The Torah. So you look at the Torah, which is the divine revelation. You feel like I will do my best with ups and downs and failures and successes to keep the Torah as best as I can, with the hope of what? With the hope of, what say that? Finding the tree of life. But, right there on the ark, are the Kruvim. And they're so childlike, and you're enamored by them, and you love them, and you want to hold them, and caress them, and kiss them, and embrace them. But they're also Kruvim, which remind you that they are the guardians that will keep you from ever achieving the entrance to the Eitz HaChayim, to the Tree of Life. You will be in process, but they're always Kruvim, which are very enticing. But behind the Kruvim, here on page 13, they are holding the sword of fire. So you want to go on the way, and you're on the way, and you're on the process, and you keep the Torah, and you try, and ultimately, the only thing, the goal of the journey, is the process itself. Because the Kruvim will always keep you up. And the reason I'm telling you that, because it's a heavy message to hear, is because everyone says, well, I've tried, unless I do this, unless I will feel the Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, what's the use of all this? And the point of the Kruvim is you're not going to go back there. You'll try to go back there. Your whole life will be an attempt to be reconnected, but those enticing Kruvim that you will want to, that just enrapture your soul, also have that hidden thing and that fire that prevents you from going back. Yes, Mark? The Torah itself is the Eitz Chaim. In other words, the Torah itself is the Eitz Chaim, and you try to do it, and the Torah is very enticing, but the difficulties of life and the trials and tribulations, and if you really look at the Torah carefully and images of God, of wrath and divine retribution and all that, that is really what the human experience is like. And therefore, we're all this in process. You hold on to the wood of the Torah and you try to re-experience it, but the sweetness of the Kruvim are not so sweet after all, because you can't really get it. What's that? Okay. How do you understand it now? The Torah is the Eitz Chaim for us. Right. And that's a big message to really get. That when you make the sanctuary for me and you want to experience God, ultimately you build a nice shul, you give a nice donation, you spend time and effort, you go to board meetings, you argue, it rips you apart, and you want to be successful, and you want the Eitz Chaim, the Tree of Life, but it doesn't work so easily. And that's really the interesting thing about the sanctuary, that if you look at a sanctuary carefully, you really get the message of what the Torah is, the difficulty of that as well. Yes? Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Angels. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very good. Very good. That a lot of people want to go back to a childlike existence. I don't want to be responsible, let people take care of me, allow myself to be nurtured, a warm blanket, and all that, and a teddy bear. No. Those are simple. As a matter of fact, here in the hospital, something is quite interesting because you see people in unusual situations. And there's quite a number of patients, primarily females, who have small little teddy bears with them. Sometimes they're married, sometimes they're not married. Not the teddy bears. Amen. And it's important. It's not to be mocked when you see someone with a teddy bear. It's their symbol of feeling nurtured. No matter how old a sense of security. It's basically the blanket in a transitional object. Yes. Very good point. That the grooving, thank you for mentioning that, grooving have the potential to contain both, which is the enticing and the destructiveness. And I guess what I'm saying, symbols are so important that you look at a grooving above the Torah and you know what your limitations are. And the limits for most of us that we can never, never reach the Eitz HaChayim. Never reach the Tree of Life. Just much. It has to, it's interesting. It's interesting. That's interesting. And the other thing that you reminded me of in Maimonides, in the guide, in part 3, chapter 54, which is one of his classic chapters of Maimonides, he describes how to go into the palace. And he goes basically, and this is a symbol of the sanctuary. So there's an exterior, and he says most people in life are outside the palace. And then you go inside, which is like an antechamber, and, well, you understand a little more, but you're still outside. Because inside is the Kodesh Kodashim, the Holy of Holies, which is the real relatedness to God. And if my memory is correct, there are like six little places in that palace where you slowly, slowly come closer and closer. According to Maimonides, the best way to approach it, this was Maimonides based on Aristotle, was through what he called philosophical demonstration. But that was purely Aristotelian. Other people would say it was Neoplatonic, depending on which philosopher. And basically, that's how different traditions arose, mystical and others, on how to get to that particular place. The key aspect, and this is what I'm emphasizing to give everyone a little solace, is you're never going to get there. But you always will be in process of getting there. What? As long as you try. Yes, Donna. So it's interesting you say that. I'll tell you what I'm listening. Oh, I listened to a tape recently of Rabbi Zalman Schefter Shlomi on spiritual aging, which was a very interesting tape. So I'm trying to. And what he basically suggests is maybe we should change the Truvin into elders. And in other words, that would be an interesting thing. Build your sanctuary, have Cherubim on one side, but have elders, a council on elders on another. That would be, that he would say, that would be your midwife for your new transition period. I said in my other class, I just want to repeat, because it's an interesting statement. He gives an example. He says, you know, when you were born, there were many midwives around helping your mother, allowing you to give birth. So he says the same thing applies to your next birth, which is the death process. And he says you have the possibility to select your midwives for your future birth. And it's interesting who you would select. to be around you at that particular time. So he adds one humorous anecdote, and with this I will conclude. I certainly would not select a person who would tell me exactly how to do it. Because that person has been with me all my life telling me exactly how to do it. Don't do it this way. Do it this way. And things like that. Back to Fields.